You're listening to CJUM FM 101.5, broadcasting from the University of Manitoba at 1200 watts.
Radio.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the ditch and the back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes, laying me down? The silence is easy to be born again, to be born again. From the far side of the ocean, if I put the wheels in motion, then I stand with my arms behind me, and push another door. Could you find me? Would you kiss my eyes, lay me down? Is silence easy to be born again, to be born again? Talking to Hugo Ledbetter, showing pictures on the wall, whispering in the hall. I'm pointing a finger at me. Putting on his little red shoes, pointing a finger at me. Between the viaducts of your dream, where a mobile steel rims crack and the ditch in the back road stop, could you find me? Would you kiss my eyes and lay me down? And silence easy to be born again. In another world, darling. in another world, in another time. Got a home on high. Ain't nothing but a stranger in this world. I'm nothing but a stranger in this world. I got a home on high. In another land. So far away. So far away. We up in the heaven. We up in the heaven. In another time, in another place, in another time, in another place. Another place.
Good evening. Welcome to Sound Companions. I'm your host, Joel Treneman. You just heard the sweet sounds of Van Morrison with Astral Weeks. So on Sound Companions, we explore records from the 60s through the 80s alongside matches from the 1990s and 2000s based on a shared theme. So we kicked it off with Astral Weeks. What do we think could possibly be paired with that? Well, the answer today is Fleet Foxes. 2011, Fleet Foxes released their second album, Helplessness Blues. And today with me, I have a co-host, my friend Sean, who's in to help figure out how these albums fit together and really to nerd out with me on some great stream of consciousness folk as the theme today. How are you doing, Sean?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's great to have friends and loyal listeners get involved with the show. I've had co-host Evan on a few times, and conversation is not always of the adult variety, and he brings a lot of jokes to the table. And today it's an opportunity to really go deep on two different albums by Van Morrison and Fleet Foxes. It's both their second album for each of these artists, and the stories of how they came together and the kind of place and time that each artist or each band was at in their evolution are drawing some interesting parallels. How would you say?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think they both kind of take that personal calming dreamlight. You kind of put it as stream of consciousness type songwriting, and even the instrumentation behind it is kind of puts you in a really calming state. And I'd also say that as far as folk was concerned, both of them kind of elevated folk to a different kind of level with some of their complex layered instrumentation. You know, I've heard Fleet Foxes referred to as chamber folk, and in the case of this Astral Weeks album, I've heard it referred to as jazz folk, and I think both of those kind of genres didn't really exist before these albums came along. So, and then I think the lyrics too, you'll see that the lyrics kind of have a lot of mythical or spiritual or nature-based themes to them. Yeah, I think there's a lot of those kind of parallels you'll see, and the fact they're second albums too.
Both artists are kind of really known for being able to master the incorporation of the natural world and kind of outdoor experiences and the beauty of the world into their music. So that's a really good take. When did you first kind of strike upon this idea that these two albums were related in such a way?
Oh, I'd say, well, both these albums are really important to me growing up. I think I just discovered Van Morrison's albums through one of those, you know, Rolling Stones top 1,000 albums you have to listen to, and discovered it, and it just kind of blew my mind how different it was from anything else. And just somehow it stuck, even though it, you know, you're talking 7-minute songs when you're only 12 years old. Somehow I stuck to it and kept listening to it, and it really started to speak to me. And then Fleet Foxes was at a time in my life when I was graduating college, and the album itself had a lot of themes that I related to, because the Help and This Is Blues albums we'll talk about has a lot of existential, what's my purpose, what am I doing here for. It helps a lot of soon-to-be college graduates, kind of speaks to them. But then listening to them a bunch more, I think I just found that both of them, as far as like the sound of the music, especially when you think about the layered harmonies with Fleet Foxes albums and just how many instruments they kind of put on top of each other, it's like almost impossible to perform live. I almost felt the same thing when I heard Astral Weeks. But I will say the irony is, the more I've researched these albums, the more I realized even though they sound the same, they could not have been produced more differently, which we'll get to as well.
That's part of the interesting dynamic of these two records. You know, both artists are really known for having, let's say, a strong attitude about how they want their music to come out. And probably in both cases, neither artist really had the opportunity to get what they wanted of their first recording efforts. And, you know, Astral Weeks, we just heard the lead track to kick off the show. Van Morrison, when he first kind of became a recording artist, he was kind of shoehorned into a folky pop, window. And he found success immediately with, the big hit Brown Eyed Girl, which I'm going to say came out in about 1967. But then what did he really want to do and record? And it turned out that when he had that opportunity with Astral Weeks, this is what we got, a different type of Van Morrison, still informed by some psychedelic influences, some 60s R&B influences, but where all of a sudden we get more jazz, we get more complex arrangements, and but a really like live from the floor kind of production goal here. So that's we'll talk a little bit more about that as the show goes on.
Yeah.
We give you one track from Astral Weeks. Let's give a sampling of Helplessness Blues from 2011, and we'll lead off the Fleet Foxes album with the song Montezuma.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Sound Companions. That was one of the standout early tracks from Fleet Foxes' Helplessness Blues, Montezuma. Let's chat a little bit about the album before we kind of get back to the Astral Weeks. So the Montezuma and the overall kind of sound and feel of Helplessness Blues kind of comes from a different place or a different process than what Astral Weeks was, how that was conceived, especially kind of following up on what we're talking about in terms of production. How does it compare? So Robin Peckold, the kind of main force behind Fleet Foxes, kind of had a similar attitude in terms of knowing, you know, what he wanted to you know, record with Fleet Foxes, but you know, how did that actually manifest compared to, you know, Van Morrison going into the studio?
Well, yeah, it's funny where you think of how Van put together everything, where he knew what he wanted, but he also let his musicians around him kind of demonstrate their musicianship, and that's really what I think carries the Astral Weeks album, is that he hired a lot of jazz and session jazz guitarists and flutist and a bassist, and they're some of the most talented musicians at the time. And he would more or less play some of his songs as a impromptu jazz session, play his lyrics, play his songs on a guitar, and they would find their ways to jump in. And so when you listen to some of the songs on Astral Weeks, you might hear it almost sounds like you're listening to a jazz session, because that's exactly what it is. It's these musicians not even knowing really the structure yet, but knowing their times to jump in, knowing the general theme of what Van wanted. And for the most part, Van would accept that. Robin's a little different. Robin would kind of painstakingly take over every meticulous detail of all the different instruments, how they would layer on top of each other and fiddle with them. One of the stories that I've heard about Helplessness Blues is that there was so much pressure around its recording, especially due to the, you know, immense success that the first album had, that they were trying to live up to it. And there's always that curse of, you know, one album band or whatever the case is. So he had a lot of pressure to keep meeting up to the expectations the first album had given them, which was almost worldwide fame instantly. And the pressure from that and the recording and the meticulous attention to detail he already had was so much that his girlfriend at the time broke up with him. But the crazy part of the story is that they broke up in the middle of the recording, but after he was able to put the album out again, she heard it and then reconciled and got back together with him because she appreciated so much.
She's like, oh, this is why you weren't paying attention to me.
Right.
You were making a great, amazing thing. Oh, yeah. I guess maybe you're not.
You weren't
so
just
bad
avoiding me
after all. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. It's interesting how with both artists too, after the big successes of their first album, you know, both sort of took like an approach where, you know, oh, that was too much too fast. I didn't want, you know, my first work to be as poppy as that, or like I wasn't actually going for that degree of instant success necessarily. Like I want my music to be more rooted in you know, more groove based, or have more complexity, or, you know, bring in like so many layers. And so that's definitely kind of how it worked out for Fleet Foxes as well. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what about you talked about some of the drama with, you know, relationships and, you know, just what it took in terms of a personal investment for the Fleet Foxes album to be made. But there's also a lot of chaos and disruption going around with Van Morrison, you know, in his life and in his sort of dealings in the music business, you know, in 1968 when they were going to record Astral Weeks. So what can you say about that?
Yeah, a lot. There's lots of stories behind this. There's even a book they wrote about when this album was being made, all this the stories around him, because it seems like something out of a movie. At the time, like you had alluded to at the start, he'd already put out one album called Blowin' Your Mind, which had Brown Eyed Girl on it, which is one of his biggest hit singles. But what a lot of people don't know is that he had no real control over the creative process for that album. It was more or less made by his record label that he had signed with pretty much shortly before that recording occurred. The tracks were just kind of put together haphazardly to try to put together as many hits. Even the album artwork, if you ever look it up, it just looks like a picture of him sweating, and it's got these psychedelic lyrics, and it's trying to promote like the psychedelia craze that was happening at that point in the late 60s. But when you listen to it, it's nothing like that. It's Brown Eyed Girl is this upbeat kind of a classic rock song, but you know, it just felt like the record exec was trying to pigeonhole him into a certain area and try to make as much money off him as he could. And in the midst of all that, he saw this, didn't like it, but he couldn't do anything about it, because like most musicians, he signed a record contract without any legal checks or any kind of reviewing of what he was actually signing himself up for. And it was a grueling contract that kind of mandated he had a certain quota of songs he had to put out. He had no control of the creative process, and he was in basically a fight for his artistic freedom leading up to this album. But that's kind of like the start of the story, where it kind of a pretty typical, you know, one band has a problem with their record label and they try to get out of their contract. That's not really that exciting. But at the time in the 1960s, this particular record label had ties to the mafia in New York. And so suddenly he found that his resisting this record label's dealings suddenly put the mafia on his back.
His stakes got really high, really fast.
They did. And then on top of all that, you throw in the fact that when he first signed up with this record label, it was a smaller record label that just started up called Bang Records. And the person that he had signed it with, this individual he had previously worked with when he was in the band Them, that was before he went solo as Van Morrison. And he had a relationship with this one individual who started the company, and it was a good working relationship, but obviously the devil was in the details, and the contract language was much less of what this person had probably promised Van at the time. So he was in the midst of kind of working with this individual, saying, you know, I thought you told me you'd give me this and this, and sorting it out. But then in the middle of all that, this individual died of a heart attack in like 1967. And then on top of all that, you've got the widow, who's a very vindictive person, who believed that Van had a part to play in her husband's death, tragically, because of the stress that he was causing her husband.
Just the whole situation.
The whole situation. And that put even more pressure on Van, to the point where between the mob and this widow who didn't really like what he was doing, he was threatened deportation because he was a resident of Northern Ireland living in New York City trying to start his career. And it basically blacklisted him from every music venue in the New York City area. So really hard to start your career when you've got all of those hurdles and you can't put out an album because they're going to say, you know, they have complete creative control and they dictate what album occurs and when. And so what blows me away is that in the midst of all of this, where he's threatened deportation, he's got the mafia on his tail, he's got a record contract on his back that he can't get out of, all that stress and hardship, he somehow puts together an album that comes off so calm and serene.
I was going to say, yeah, maybe
you know,
that was
it feels like
solace.
He could have put out a punk album or something with this kind of influence in his life, you know? Just so much frustration.
In 1968, he could have, you know, teamed up with Iggy and the Stooges.
That's right.
Or MC5 or something and, you know, tried to jumpstart punk or metal even before the 70s came around.
Tell us how you really feel, Van, you know? Like, he had those opportunities. But I mean, and I will say, though, it's funny where if you listen to the music of Astral Weeks, you'll think that, yeah, there's no real strife in this person's life. But the lyrics of a lot of the songs, if you really break them down, he is talking about his experience at the time. They're not exactly positive lyrics. There really is only one song on the album that I'd say is a truly positive, uplifting song, both lyrically and musically, which we'll talk about later in the episode. But But yeah, just if you take the lyrics out, it's just the sound of what he's producing is so calming that it's just an irony when you think of everything he's going through. So, and I think one thing I forgot to mention this whole story is that when the record was being made, a lot of what happened to kind of resolve all the issues, to deal with his New York issue, he basically had to leave the city. He ended up moving to Boston, and most of the record was created through there. He ended up getting most of the musicians that play on the album were from the Boston area. They were just people that he found in the coffee shop circuits and things like that. And then he also had to have a somewhat arranged marriage with his girlfriend at the time in order to keep his U.S. residency and continue to make music.
His green card, so to speak.
Yeah. So all that kind of resolved in short order, but it was still probably lingering in his mind for sure. And if we have time, I have one more little segment about this story that I think is hilarious.
Let's let the people hear a couple tracks.
Sure.
And then we'll come back and continue on. Here's another song from Astral Weeks, The Way Young Lovers Do, and we'll follow it up with Battery Kinsey by the Fleet Foxes.
We strolled through fields all wet with rain, and back along the lane again. There in the sunshine, in the sweet summertime, the way that young lovers do. I kissed you on the lips once more, and we said goodbye at your front door in the nighttime. Yeah, that's the right time to feel the way that young lovers do. Then we sat down
101.5 UMFM. You're listening to Sound Companions. Well, let's save that. I'm your host, Joel Treneman. Today, Sean is with me as co-host, and we're talking about 1968's Astral Weeks by Van Morrison and Helplessness Blues, the second album from Fleet Foxes. And we are going to fit in as many songs as we can in the next 20-25 minutes, but we really like talking about this album. So it's a rare Sound Companions departure where we fill you in on some of the deep, nerdy aspects of albums. Right, Sean? So what else would you like to say about how Astral Weeks came together in this context?
Well, we kind of left it as a cliffhanger of the last funny story of the Astral Weeks recording process. And what I'd mentioned to you is that at the same time as this recording, you know, we kind of skipped over some details for the sake of time. But in order to get out of this contract that eventually let Van put out the masterpiece that is Astral Weeks, his existing contract with Bang Records kind of forced him to produce a certain amount of songs in a very set period of time, basically nonstop, had to produce one every month, something like that. And that's part of the reason he wanted to get out of it. In order to close out the contract, he basically finally said, you know what, I'll do what they want. But he knew that there was really no stipulation as to the quality of what he made. And so what occurred after that was a production of 36 basically nonsense tracks. You can now find these. These do exist. There's like a bootleg album. I can't remember the name of it, but it was one of the later Van Morrison releases that put together all of those songs from the Bang Records days. And I've heard clips of them, and they're just nonsense. They're just him strumming guitar, and he already has a very kind of rambling type song singing style to begin with, but this one takes it to a whole new level where there is no theme whatsoever. Even the title tracks, if you read some of them out, they're hilarious. So I'd recommend that to anybody if you want to do the deep dive like Joel and I are doing, to listen to just what it sounds like when an artist has to be forced to make material to satisfy a record label.
It's definitely a case of passive-aggressive revenge recording, sort
yes.
of, or like, so I have to do this? Well, this is what you're going to get out of me then. Technically, this is fulfilling my contractual obligation, but I'm going to show you what I actually think about this by phoning it in, sort of, or really just like putting whatever I have to down on tape in order to just get you off my back.
That's right.
Yep. Yeah, it's there's probably some other great examples of how this has gone down. Maybe that's a future show in the making.
I would love that show.
I think we could see some themes coming together there.
Wouldn't be the highest quality music you've ever heard, but it would definitely be a theme.
Well, you know, to each their own, I think there's probably the occasional sort of almost unintentional gem
yep.
that has come out of, you know, that type of angry recording. But it's generally not the artist's best work or what they, you know, would want you to hear in the end to remember their career or to move forward. But if they exist, we can check them out. So in 2008, Fleet Foxes put out a very successful first record, as we mentioned. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure from the instant success, you know, from their fandom, but, you know, really from themselves in a lot of ways. And so when it came to, you know, create a follow-up and to work on Helplessness Blues, you know, tell me a little bit about how, you know, that was coming to be, or the interesting stories and parallels from that.
Yeah, I think, well, the thing with Robin's recording of Helplessness Blues is that it's very obvious, even from track one that we heard, the Montezuma track, that there's a theme of existentialism, wondering one's purpose, wondering what we're doing here, that suddenly Robin kind of lays on very thick on every single track off this album, to the point where I've heard some people call it a concept album because of that. But I think at the time, it's hard to put yourself in Robin's head, but it felt like because he was so young and so immediately successful, which, like you said, no one in the band really expected, he suddenly, he himself, at the ripe old age of 24, started to say to himself, you know, why am I here? What's my purpose? How do I feel fulfilled in life? And decided to put that into all of his lyrics, while at the same time doing it the way only Robin can do, where he tells you these stories through sometimes mythological stories, fables from the 1500s, things of that nature that still bring home the same general messages. And so the song we're about to play, which is the title track off this album, Helplessness Blues, is often seen as by lots as the best song off the album. Some people have called it like the best song of this millennium because it spoke to a generation of people, myself included. Because what it's telling you is it's I would say some pretty straight and narrow lyrics talking about the narrator of the song kind of questioning their existence and saying, you know, all through their life they've been told they're supposed to be special, but how can we all be special and make the world still turn? And whether or not someone could feel comfortable, kind of what he puts as one of those lyrics, to be the cog in the great machine, whether or not that's something that, why not feel okay with that? Why do I have to feel like I need to be this unique snowflake amongst snowflakes? And I think a lot of people graduating from college at the time, myself included, thought the same thing. You know, you go to college, you think you're going to take over the world and you're going to do this and this, and then you start to come to realization you just might just do that same 9-to-5 as everyone else. And is that necessarily bad? Maybe you can still find purpose in something else. Maybe that is your purpose and there's nothing wrong with that. And so his song goes through all of that in a really epic, loud folk ballad, if I can say that. It feels like loud ballad and folk don't quite mix, but this one definitely brings that home. And yeah, it kind of speaks to the entire theme of the entire album. And like I said, it's as far as how it was produced and what it does, it's a lot of people see it as one of their favorite songs of all time.
It's often cited as one of the best songs of this short century so far, or at least as the best song in Fleet Foxes' catalog by many fans and critics. I feel like that's a lot of hype. I'm just going to have to play it like right now. This is Helplessness Blues.
I was raised up believing I was somehow unique, like a snowflake, distinct among snowflakes, unique in each way you can see. And now after some thinking, I'd say I'd rather be a functioning cog in some great machinery, serving something beyond me. But I don't know. the hedges burst. And I will drink the clear, clean water for to quench my thirst. And I'll show out the ferry boats and they'll get high on a blue ocean against tomorrow's sky. And I will never grow so old. And I will walk and talk in gardens all wet with rain. Oh, oh, sweet thing, sweet thing. Yeah, sweet thing. Shall take me strongly in your arms again. And I won't remember that I ever felt the pain. We shall walk and talk in gardens all misty wet, a misty wet with rain down. And I will never, never, never grow so old.
On Sound Companions, Van Morrison versus Fleet Foxes. That was Sweet Thing, the third track from Astral Weeks, the 1968 masterpiece by Van Morrison. And before that, the title track, Helplessness Blues, from 2011's release by Fleet Foxes. Sweet Thing is probably the best known, most famous track from Astral Weeks, and it kind of got people thinking or hoping like, oh, this is more like the Van Morrison of Brown-Eyed Girl, maybe. You know, that's the sort of the song that provides like one of the stronger links in his catalog to what had been made and what was to come.
Yep. It's the only one I think that's on most of the best of albums.
think the other thing is, lyrically, it's probably the most positive song. I think every other song, like I mentioned, they have this uplifting, calming sound to them, but the lyrics are Van more or less ranting about the horrible experiences he's had in his life to this point, whereas Sweet Thing is a true love song through and through, talking about his girlfriend / immediate wife due to the visa issues, and describing the love they have.
Yeah, there's like a romantic aspect to it, and kind of like a poetic backdrop. But yeah, more with a positive bent than some of the beautiful but bleak, lyrical treatments on the other tracks. What about lyrically? How do you think that kind of fits with the Fleet Foxes and the writing, the songwriting that went into Helplessness Blues?
I think the lyric theme that connects them both is just the spiritual mystic type lyrical themes that they both play to. Both lyrics kind of talk about things from stories or from mythical creatures or different like historic stories that kind of like, yeah, they kind of connect, but at the end of the day, the major themes I would say are quite different, with the existentialism of Robin's focus at that point in time in his life. And then in Van's case, he was just kind of connecting all kinds of loose concepts. And again, you have to remember we're talking the late 1960s. So the psychedelia movement was in full effect. And a lot of his songs are things that just pop into his head in ways that that are very, very abstract in the grand scheme of things. Like the title track we started this whole episode with is him talking about venturing through the slipstream of his own dreams and seeing himself in the past and saying to himself, if he grew up in the past somewhere else, would he still live the same life? You know, like the kind of things you might hear at 2 a.m. at a party in the late 1960s were the themes of Van's record. But Robin, on the other hand, was very, very introspectual and, you know, I would dare say overthinks a little bit with some of his lyrics.
The overthinking seems to be the case. But like in that similar type of like late night reflection where you're experiencing the angst and you don't have an immediate outlet for it, and you know, you're writing it down in a song or a journal, and then trying to make sense of it later, and or your producer's trying to make sense of it as you're trying to craft these songs into some type of unified vision.
Yep.
The in this case, that producer was a guy named Phil Eck for the Fleet Foxes, and he had helmed their kind of breakthrough self-titled release initially in 2008. And I want to mention him because I think he is kind of an underrated producer as far as, the indie rock and indie folk kind of renaissance of the late 90s and 2000s. He first kind of got into producing in the Pacific Northwest by working with Built to Spill, and kind of turned, you know, some of their music into a more accessible but still raw and emotional work with 1994's There's Nothing Wrong with Love, and went on to produce some pretty giant albums by Modest Mouse and Built to Spill. The Shins, a lot of you may remember Shoots Too Narrow or Wincing the Night Away from the early 2000s.
Great albums.
Band of Horses, kind of fit into this tree as well. And, we shouldn't forget Father John Misty, who was, as you know, in his real name, a huge part of the Fleet Foxes' Helplessness Blues album.
Yeah, he was, he's better known as Josh Tillman, that's his real name, and he was the drummer for the Fleet Foxes band all through the production of their second album, the one that we're listening to here. He was added on after the first album was put out and just toured with them. But yeah, the infamous thing of Father John's Misty's connection to the band is that they really had some animosity between them that kind of came to a head during the recording process for this album, because at the time, Josh had already put out a bunch of songs through his artist named Jay Tillman, and he was doing quite well. But I think we've kind of alluded to the perfectionist ways of Robin, and I think Josh was finding a lot of friction with that and feeling that he was kind of creatively controlled or stymied by Robin's overarching control over the entire process. And also, I would imagine they probably saw him as more of the session drummer than someone who can contribute in a meaningful way to the songs that were mainly Robin's vision. And it got to the point where the infamous thing that you know about is that they were going to split up amicably. The record label Sub Pop convinced them to stay together and perform the tour of the Helplessness Blues album in its entirety. And it proceeded to be one of the worst decisions they made, because they were already at the edge of their relationship, kind of on edge with each other. And then to be forced to tour the world together just took it to another level. And they pretty much ended as poorly as you could imagine in that case. And almost, I don't know about all the details, but I feel like almost out of spite for her experience, Josh, when he put out his debut album as Father John Misty, it's titled Fear Fun. And everyone who's in the know knows that it's an acronym, FF, which is exactly the same acronym as the band Fleet Foxes. And it's supposed to be a very overt nod to his opinion of the creative process with Robin involved. So,
yeah, it's always hard to tell how, you know, these things go from the outside and the, you know, in this case, he said yep. Type of thing. But there does seem to be a lot of ink spilled about the kind of controlling, vision or force of Robin Peckold and Fleet Foxes. And maybe that's moderated a bit in, you know, later stages of their career. And hopefully everyone's a little more comfortable all around. But the interesting thing, like, and one of the kind of shared themes between these albums is how that level of conflict and just like swirling forces that were happening outside the studio really led to some extremely powerful art in the studio. And, you know, it's a great kind of metaphor or theme for life and art in general. But it didn't lead to the continued relationship, within Fleet Foxes. And depending on, you know, what you think about the band, we can debate another day whether or not this was the creative peak of Fleet Foxes with him on drums. But it's a moot point. The this album, though, did pave the way for a lot of other artists to kind of come through, the pocket created by the success of Fleet Foxes. And this is about the time in the kind of 2010 to 2015 range where a lot of kind of, I use the term indie folk loosely, or, you know, chamber folk, orchestral folk, a little bit of poppiness, a little bit of traditional influence. A lot of bands were able to build on the success of Fleet Foxes and kind of, you know, build careers from that.
Yep. Yeah, you've got Lumineers and Mumford & Sons, I would say, are kind of the most infamous examples. I know they all came out around the same time, but I think it's arguable that they would never have been able to make the same dent that they did and kind of create a sound of their own that's much more commercially acceptable if they didn't have Fleet Foxes putting out their debut album and then kind of solidifying this genre with the Helplessness Blues album in 2011.
Even in Canada, a group like the Strombellas really,
absolutely,
really benefited from this. And even a lot of more like solo, like smaller time artists that kind of were able to build careers out of the folk revival. But, you know, there's been a folk revival, per se, many times over the years. We're going to play a couple of songs to kind of close off this episode. And, you know, one of those comes from Crosby, Stills, and Nash. So prior to, or, you know, maybe even the same year, actually this might be out in 67 or 68, Crosby, Stills, and Nash put out their debut album, Deja Vu. And in some quarters, that was like a folk revival then, but more of a revival of folk music in, say, the 1940s. So it kind of shows how the influences kind of continue to move down through the years. Well, Sean, thanks so much for joining today for this episode. Do you have any kind of closing thoughts or overview of today's show that you want to throw in before we kind of let the listeners out with two songs?
It's been great having me. I think this is a very fun process. I enjoy talking music, and especially when the albums are so close to me as these two were. I thought it was great that you offered to have me guest host when I suggested this to you, since you knew I know so much about it. And it's hard to tell for anyone listening just how much Joel has to multitask while doing this, so you should appreciate the talent he's putting forward every time, because there's probably three different things he's doing while he's talking to you on the air, and it's quite impressive. But yeah, maybe we'll do this again sometime if we think of another good idea that we all feel passionate about.
That would be great. Sean has got a real ear for great music and the kind of exciting brain that can go down these rabbit holes with me and figure out how albums fit together. And as I've thrown out in the past, listeners, if you too have an idea about a couple of albums or even one album where you want to kind of consider how it fits in the broader canon or music history, feel free to go to umfm.com, find the Sound Companions webpage. You can see the show themes, the podcasts, and the track listings for every show we've done, and you can find my email address there. So please feel free to check that out. Thanks so much for listening. We'll try to have Sean back again. Maybe a little bit of Lou Reed and his machine sounds. There's got to be a modern equivalent for an artist going out into experimental left field and taking the listeners on, let's say, an uncomfortable, sonically uncomfortable journey.
Absolutely.
So we'll be happy to come back to you soon. Close off the show today. We're going to play 4 plus 20 from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And then one of those groups that we mentioned, Mumford & Sons, with their huge hit, I Will Wait. Thanks for listening, and have a great evening.
Four and 20 years ago, I come into this life, the son of a woman and a man who lived in strife. He was tired of being poor, and he wasn't into selling door to door, and he worked like the devil to be more. A different kind of poverty now upsets me so. Night after sleepless night, I walk the floor and I want to know, why am I so alone? Where is
is my woman. Can I bring her home? Have I driven her away? Is she gone? Morning comes the sunrise, and I'm driven to my bed. I see that it is empty, and there's devils in my head. I embrace the many-colored beast. I grow weary of the torment. Can there be no peace? And I find myself just wishing that my life would simply cease. Strong and use my head alongside my heart. So tame my flesh and fix my eyes, a tethered mind.